Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. We had a real special opportunity to sit down with Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas about some breaking news, one would say, about coronavirus, China, and immigration. I think you guys are going to love this conversation. He has been out front on these issues, and this is a really important conversation, and we did it during CPAC, and I think it's going to make some news. It's an exclusive conversation, so I hope you enjoy it here on The Charlie Kirk Show.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
All right. I'm sitting here with Senator Tom Cotton. Thanks so much for joining the Charlie Kirk Show.
Thanks, Charlie. It's great to be on with you.
Yeah. So I want to get started by first just complimenting you and thanking you for taking a courageous stand on the spread of this virus, coronavirus. I think it was about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I saw a tweet come across and you were grilling China for being deceitful and dishonest, which is a feature of the, you know, the tyrant communist Chinese party. So can you just first give us, can we walk backwards of how this all started? We don't know patient zero. We've been lied to by the Chinese on this because now this is the number one topic in America, and you've been warning us about it for quite some time.
Yeah, it's the number one topic in the world. And I remember in mid-January, while the impeachment trial was still going, having a conversation with President Trump and telling him that if it wasn't for the impeachment trial, this would be the number one topic in the world. In fact, Chuck Schumer would probably be standing in front of a hospital somewhere with a face mask on, attacking the president for not doing enough, as is the case today now that the trial is over. But from the very beginning, when I first started seeing reports of an unusual viral pneumonia in Wuhan, in China, I started studying it pretty carefully and looking at what was happening. And you're right, there's still so many unknowns. Most notably, we still don't know where the virus started. We know it was in or near Wuhan. The Chinese Communist Party said for weeks that it was at a raw food market. But even they now admit that that's not the case. So it's possible that it was naturally occurring at, say, another food market or a farm or a food processor or what have you. But as I've noted from the very beginning, there is a super lab in Wuhan that deals with infectious diseases to include coronavirus. So it's only reasonable and responsible that we ask the question about whether or not that lab has some connection. And it could be a negligent but unintentional connection. You know, China has a history of their laboratories not successfully containing diseases that they're researching. But we need to demand those answers from the Chinese Communist Party because they have been so dishonest and they've lacked transparency from the very beginning. And we need to put the burden of proof on them because the origins of the virus can, of course, effect and has implications for diagnostic testing, therapeutic drugs, and vaccines.
Well, and you were called by the media a conspiracy theorist for dare pointing out that they have the super lab in Wuhan, and we still have no idea who patient zero is. The Chinese have gone on our news networks. The Chinese ambassador or some equivalent to that was saying, was attacking you, basically saying that you're spreading, you know, false propaganda and that we need to, you know, this is really not as bad as, you know, we think. Now it's worldwide. It's slowing the global economy to a halt. Apple has already seen it directly affect its production. And I have to ask the question, how are we going to hold the Chinese accountable for this? And, you know, I've been rather harsh on them for a lot of different reasons on trade and, you know, hacking our cyber grid and sending spies into our universities. But this is slowing the entire world down, and it's there to blame for it, whether it was in their super lab or not. And so I guess, will there be some form of repercussions on them?
Yeah, I think the world is naturally going to start reassessing its relationship with China because of this outbreak. And if it becomes a true pandemic worldwide, perhaps on all continents, even in all nations, I think that reassessment is inevitable. It's overdue for other reasons. Some of the other reasons you cite, like China stealing our jobs or our property over the last few decades, or trying to infiltrate our universities or Confucius other sensitive Institutes. Laboratories yeah. and so forth. So it's long overdue. This outbreak may be the grounds that finally causes not just a lot of Americans, but people around the world to reassess. So, for instance, we unfortunately are dependent to a degree, not only in manufacturing in general, but pharmaceutical manufacturing yeah. and medical manufacturing on China. That is not a healthy place to be. It's a concern I've raised for a long time. I think now people's eyes are open to the need to diversify where we source products around the world. I mean, the best case scenario, of course, is to bring those jobs and that production back to the United States. And we're seeing some of that.
Yes.
But at a minimum, we should be trying to focus more on sourcing with friendly nations as opposed to our chief geopolitical rival. Yeah. I think that's one of the main prices China is going to pay from this. But you are right that however this virus started and whatever path it took out of Wuhan around China and then around the world, it is the responsibility of the Chinese Communist Party. It is a feature, not a bug, of their system of government to be deceitful, to lack transparency, to try to cover things up. If they were open, transparent, and honest from the very beginning, then perhaps this virus wouldn't have spread so quickly within China and affected so many Chinese, yeah. who we should remember are the first and the worst victims of the Chinese
yes,
Communist Party.
And they're being held hostage
and then
by
gotten,
the tyrants.
And then gotten outside of their borders. If this had happened in the United States or in a country like Japan or a country like Denmark, the outbreak may not have been so severe because local authorities and public health officials are properly encouraged to be open and transparent, report bad news up the chain of command, and to deal with the problem swiftly. The reason this spread so swiftly in China, in part, is because of the system the Chinese Communist Party has imposed on the Chinese people.
With this new year, it's time to get started on improving yourself. No one knows that better than one of my favorite sponsors, Vincero. They do great, Mr. Producer's wearing the watch right now. These guys know just how important it is to look and feel your best, and they are here to help you keep motivated through 2020 and beyond. If you're looking to upgrade your look, don't waste money on a cheap cookie-cutter watch that doesn't get you noticed. Finding a watch that's stylish, bold, and built to last can cost a pretty penny. Vincero Watches is changing that. They believe you deserve to look good no matter what your budget is. You deserve better than settling for something underwhelming. So right now, head to VinceroWatches.com and check out my favorite picks and take advantage of my special discounts while you shop. Remember to use the code KIRK, K-I-R-K. Vincero understands the frustrations of online shopping. These guys get it. And that's why they make it easy and possible for you. Vincero offers free shipping and 30-day returns and guarantees your watch for 2 years. It's stress-free shopping with fair and honest prices. When you put it on, you immediately know you get more than you paid for. It's the best value for your money, guaranteed. That is why Vincero has over 20,000 five-star reviews on their site, and you can read it for yourself. No matter who you are, what your job is, how old you are, or where you live, there will always be an occasion when you'll want or need to look your best. Dates, interviews, weddings, nights out, interviews. You want to be the one that stands out, with the one being this year. Put yourself in a position to accomplish your goals to feel your absolute best. So I'm telling you right now, don't overpay for a watch that looks cheap and disappoints. This is a timepiece you'll use. This is a timepiece that will last. This is something that will help you look and feel incredible so that you'll feel prepared to take on a day and accomplish everything you set out to do this year. So this deal really is too good to pass up. Go to VinceroWatches.com, that's V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. Use my discount code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for a discount at checkout. Do not pay full price on these beautiful timepieces. Use my code K-I-R-K, KIRK, at checkout.
So where we stand today, there's a lot of panic, and I use that word intentionally, and I'm afraid it's only going to get worse, and a lot of uncertainty. What can you share to put people's minds at ease? Or maybe we should just be brutally honest and say it's going to get worse.
So I wouldn't panic. I wouldn't be completely at ease, though. I would be properly cautious. Mm-hmm. For normal Americans in their day-to-day lives, the risk today remains low. They can continue to engage in practices that keep those risks low. Simple things the same way we avoid the flu, by washing your hands regularly, avoiding large crowds if you're sick, so on and so forth. I know the president, based on what he said last night's press conference and my conversations with him, is laser focused on preventing an outbreak in this country, and that's where we should be. It may be hard. We just had a case reported in California that doesn't have obvious origins, but it's easier to contain one case than it is 100 cases, and something that is possible is not inevitable. So the president has got the entire government moving in the direction it needs to be, which is prepared for the worst, but working overtime to prevent it, to do things like getting test kits out to the front lines and quickly responding to any kind of even suspected case, so you don't have the kind of generalized spread in communities that we see in China and unfortunately now in countries like Japan and South Korea as well.
And it's important to note it's not the flu, but it could be similar.
It's not the flu, and I don't think that's a sound analogy, because it is, right now, based on the evidence we have, much more deadly than the flu, somewhere between 20 and 30 times more deadly than the flu. Now, it does seem to affect the same kinds of people that die from the flu every year, which tend to be the elderly and the infirm, so people that have already had lung problems, as opposed to young and healthy persons. But if the virus is that highly transmissible as the flu is, which is what drives the annual deaths of the flu, is that it's so transmissible, even though the mortality rate is far below 1%. But the mortality rate of coronavirus remains at 2% or even goes higher. You could be talking about tens or hundreds of thousands of people dying worldwide, maybe even millions, if it's a completely uncontained outbreak across the globe. But that's one reason why, hard as it may be, our government needs to focus like a laser right now on trying to prevent these outbreaks in the United States, and if they happen, trying to get them contained into the lowest numbers possible.
Well, and again, you deserve a lot of thanks for your courage, because it's not easy to call out the CCP and have them do a full, you know, full propaganda spree trying to call you all these horrible names. I tried to offer as much air support as I could
on
social media.
You did. You offered a lot of fire support. I appreciate it. I'm kind of used to it with the Chinese Communist Party, between standing up for Taiwan or trying to stop
Hong Kong,
China from infiltrating our telecommunications network. But you can tell that they are particularly sensitive about this virus, in part because it reflects so poorly at a fundamental level on the communist system of government that they have imposed on China.
Most definitely. And at a different time, a different date, I want to talk about the Confucius Institutes, because they should all be kicked out of U.S. universities.
Yeah, well, I'll just say for all your listeners, because some of them may be college students who have them on their campus, that Confucius Institutes on our campuses are little more than Chinese Communist Party intelligence outposts.
Yes, with server rooms and potential spy operations. So shifting gears, I do want to talk to you about the RAISE Act, which I'm an advocate of. And I think that we as conservatives need to talk about reform, not just on illegal immigration, but legal immigration. And I think this conversation is going to come to a head in the conservative movement of how many green cards are the right number to issue. And so can you talk about the RAISE Act and why you're pushing it through? And if I were to predict the future, I think you're going to see a lot more support growing for it in the coming years. Yeah.
So the RAISE Act focuses very, very precisely on green cards that are given out each single year. We put aside temporary worker programs, which are often controversial in their own right. We put aside all questions about border security or workplace enforcement, all of which is important. But the way we make citizens in this country, which is giving out green cards, which puts you on the path to citizenship, I think is one of the most important things we do. There's hardly anything more valuable in the world than being an American citizen. There's no more consequential act that we take as a people than admitting other persons to become part of the United States. For the longest time, it has been kind of a very foolish approach, done arbitrarily and just by happenstance over the years. I mean, things like the diversity lottery, which bizarrely privilege Europeans over almost every other continent, or chain migration, which if you just happen to have a brother who got here 30 years ago, you're advantaged over many other people who might fit into our economy more effectively. And what it really doesn't do is serve the needs of the American people in our economy today. Only about 1 in 14 of every green card we issue is based on ability to stand on your own 2 feet, get a job, contribute to our economy, help other people get jobs as well. So what we did a couple of years ago is look carefully at the best immigration systems in the world, places like Australia and Canada, and said, let's just start over on the way we issue green cards. Let's make it a very simple, straightforward program. It's not based on any arbitrary quotas for countries or arbitrary things like a diversity lottery or family relationships going out to the third or second degree of a family. What do we need people coming to America to succeed with? Very simple, clear evidence. First is ability to speak English. Second is educational achievement, especially in technical backgrounds. Third is having a job offer in hand, a job offer that pays a good wage for your community. Different to be in Little Rock, Arkansas versus San Francisco, California. Fourth is your age. The younger you are, the longer you're going to be able to contribute to our society, building the economy, creating jobs, paying taxes, and so forth. Fifth is making taking account for certain exceptional skills. So, you know, baseball players or world-class musicians or world-class scientists, so on and so forth. We take those and a few other factors, kind of put them all just into a mathematical equation, and it kicks out a number, and the top scoring people every few months are the ones who are going to get the green cards. Much more effective way to get the workers that we need in our country who are going to succeed and stand up on their feet from the very first day. It's different than we've ever done it, but you know, the needs of our economy are very different as well. You know, this is not the 18th century when we had, or the 19th century where we had an entire continent that we needed to populate. It's not the early 20th century where we had mass production assembly lines that needed millions and millions of workers. If anything today, a big concern in our economy is that we're going to be losing too many jobs to things like automation. So we need to make sure that we're getting the right mix of skills and talents from the immigrants that we draw nationwide. If we do that, we'd no doubt get the world's very best coming here every single year. I mean, I've talked to some of these officials in places like Canada who hope that we fail in doing this because they get some of the world's most talented immigrants because those immigrants can't get here for whatever reason.
Sure.
If you had a choice between going to Canada and the United States because you had a better, you had an idea, you wanted to be an entrepreneur, you wanted to build a business, of course you'd come to the United States because of the rule of law, respect for property rights and contract rights, lower taxes, larger workforce, so on and so forth. So we have a chance to both get the right mix of skills in our immigrant pool, and also create a lot of new jobs and economic opportunity for Americans who are here today.
And there's an argument to be made that a tighter labor pool will raise wages for Americans.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's just the simple law of supply and demand, which most conservatives support. It's like the law of gravity, except when it comes to immigration. They seem to think that if you continue to import more unskilled and more low-skilled workers, that somehow that's not going to impact wages for today's low-skilled or unskilled
workers. Yeah, I hear that argument sometimes in conservative circles. What would be your retort to that?
Again, it's just the law of supply and demand. If you bring in more unskilled workers and put them into the pool of unskilled workers, of course it's going to hold down or even drive down wages. Something tells me if we had mass migration with no restrictions whatsoever for lawyers and for TV pundits and for academics, they might be singing a different tune.
That's a very good point.
Since we essentially have mass migration, both legal and illegal, for unskilled and low-skilled workers up until about 3 years ago, they're not that worried about it. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it benefits them because they benefit, again, from keeping wages down, whether they're a business owner or maybe they're hiring immigrant labor in immigrant-heavy fields, construction, landscaping, childcare, so on and so forth.
Hospitality. Yeah.
But guess who it hurts the most? It doesn't to control unskilled and low-skilled immigration. It helps unskilled and low-skilled workers, which often are the last generation of immigrants. So in those industries that are most heavily populated by immigrants, the people you're going to hurt the most are the yesterday's immigrants, people who came to this country 5, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you continue to bring in unskilled and low-skilled workers, you're simply displacing them or making them less competitive in the labor marketplace.
Yeah, and so to kind of the final thought on that in the time we have remaining is I hear this argument that there is a huge worker shortage in America, and I look at the numbers, and there are more job openings than there are Americans to fill them. That's actually why we're seeing wages go up. But there's also a lot of people that are on the sidelines, particularly in urban communities, for the longest period of time. I would make the argument we need to think a little bit more creatively about our disenfranchised populations instead of just opening our doors endlessly to satisfy the needs, wants, and concerns of sometimes transnational corporations.
Yeah, there is no worker shortage in America. There is anywhere from 40 to 50 million people, many of whom are adults and able-bodied, who are not in the workforce, or they're working part-time and they can't get full-time work. Anyone who says we can't, there's a labor shortage, or
American, I hear it a lot
from, or Americans want to do that job.
Business owners, I hear it. They say, I can't find people. We gotta get more people from overseas. And I heard it, and now I'm questioning it.
Yeah. So anytime someone says an American won't do that job, or I can't find workers, what they mean is at current wages.
That's a very good point.
At current wages. So if they paid a little bit more, they'd probably be more likely to get people to come work for mm-hmm. them. Or a lot of companies in this economy have had to offer a lot of non-wage benefits, which are also very good for workers. So for instance, FedEx now has a program where they are driving people more than 2 hours on a bus to work in between Memphis and Mississippi. That is a good thing. That's not a bad thing. Other companies are offering more flex time. They're offering student loan repayment. They're offering classes for people who need a GED degree or want to get an associate degree. All those non-wage forms, examples of compensation, in addition to just basic on-the-job training that workers are increasingly going to get mm-hmm. in a tight labor market, those are all good things. They are not bad things, and that we should be focused on those kinds of ways to get Americans into the workforce before we start looking overseas to bring people into work.
Yes.
Like, the RAISE Act is about green cards, but you could also apply this thinking, of course, to temporary visas as well. Take H-2B visas, which are the so-called non-agricultural mm-hmm. Visas.
Because there's a lot of discussion about that right now.
Yeah. So a lot of politicians in Washington want to triple it, quadruple it, in part because they hear people that say, well, we can't get workers to come. These are often like seasonal kind of work, like lifeguards in the summer, ski instructors or ski lift operators in the winter, or people working in the seafood industry when it's busiest time of the year. I know that there are a lot of poor kids who don't have much opportunity in Izard County, Arkansas, and Jefferson County, Arkansas, who would love nothing more than to go to Mackinac Island in the summer and be a lifeguard, or go to Aspen and be a ski lift operator. You may have to give them a little bit of training, but you already have the entire infrastructure to bring in people from Croatia or from Poland. So why not, rather than fly people over from overseas and house them, why not put people on a bus from Izard County, Arkansas, or Jefferson County, Arkansas, and drive them to the Outer Banks of North Carolina, or drive them to the resort in Sedona, and let them hand out towels there? Well, get them a job, teach them job skills, let them take those back home, and continue to climb up the economic ladder.
And I think the answer to that on the left is they want an unlimited supply of people from overseas because they like the way they potentially are going to vote. And for the right, it's getting nonstop fed a narrative from businesses that we've tried it, there's no Americans, we've given up. And I think that's nonsense.
It is nonsense. And if you look at the data, actually, you'll see it's nonsense. If you look at the occupational data from the Department of Labor, there literally is no job that an American won't do. There are certain parts of the country, in large part because of immigration, that jobs are predominantly immigrant. But across this country, there is no job, not even in the jobs that some elites in Washington, New York think is all.
They'll say, oh, yeah. And, it's an unbelievably racist thing to say, where they say, well, who's going to mow your lawn? I'm like, oh, that's all you think that, immigrants can do? I think it's very, they're being racist when they say that.
It is. And it cuts in both ways as well, because it's very condescending to Americans.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Like there are a lot of Arkansans who work hard in the hospitality industry, at Holiday Inns and Comfort Inns all around the state, or who work hard in the landscaping business, or work hard in the home building business. That may not be the case in Bethesda, Maryland, or Arlington, Virginia, but it is the case in Arkansas and a lot of other places. And we need to do everything we can to get Americans back in the workforce, especially able-bodied Americans who are in their adult years, who are 18 to 65 years old. There's some problems with government welfare programs here, not making work not pay, and we can reform those programs as well. But we need to do everything we can to get Americans who are not working and who should be working back in the workforce. And we have an obligation to do so to them as our fellow citizens, not just to discard them and bring in a low-wage immigrant to please business owners.
Yeah, that's a great point.
What if you could combine all your credit card balances into one low, fixed monthly payment? Now you can, and it's easy, with my friends at Lightstream. Get a fixed credit card consolidation loan as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. You can pay off your credit card balances and save thousands of dollars in interest. I know a lot of people that are suffering under this. There is a pathway out. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with absolutely no fees. The application is 100% online, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that when you have good credit, you deserve a low rate and great service, and that's exactly what they deliver. Lightstream does terrific work, and I know a lot of people that have really benefited from the work that they do. So just for my listeners, apply now to get an additional interest rate discount to save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/Kirk. That's lightstream.com/Kirk for an additional discount. LIGHTSTREAM.com/Kirk. Subject to credit approval. Rates include 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Kirk for more information.
So from what I understand, the proposed number of green cards would be to go down then.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
So what we did with the RAISE Act was recalibrate the categories. So we eliminated the arbitrary country caps, arbitrary occupational caps. Bizarrely, I know that you'll be shocked to hear this, as will your listeners. We have quotas set aside for foreign lawyers to come to this country. As if we have a lawyer shortage
no,
in America.
We have a lawyer surplus.
So we eliminate all that. We constrict chain migration down to what I think most Americans would support, the nuclear family, your immediate family. Eliminate the diversity lottery. The way the math works out there is you go from about 1 million green cards a year to around 500,000
so
over about a 10-year period.
I had a conversation with an undisclosed individual who said, well, 1 million as percentage of our population is actually a lot lower than what most other countries are offering, and green card doesn't mean citizenship, and it's a long process. And I'm not going to say who it was, but it's someone who's high up and someone that can make decisions. And that's what I get when I say I support the RAISE Act. So what would you say to that as a counter argument?
So green card doesn't necessarily mean citizenship, but that's in the decision of the green card holder. I mean, once you have a green card,
it's like the gateway to citizenship.
Yeah, once you have a green card, you can basically have all the rights of a citizen except for voting itself. And if you want to become a citizen, it's really your decision. It's not our decision as a people through our government to decide. That's why green card is so valuable for someone to have in the United States or anywhere around the world. On the numbers, so I'm willing to negotiate on the total numbers. I think 1 million is too high and has been too high for a long time. When we have 40 to 50 million people who are still out of work, even in the fourth year of the Trump economy, when labor markets are so tight.
But is that 1 million people currently in America, or is it people that are being redomiciled?
Combination of both. Combination of both. Because some people might be in a non-working status. They might be a spouse of an immigrant, or they might be a student. Or it might be people who've been waiting in line in their country.
So it's even more than that number of people that
and
are.
It's just, I mean, it's like adding, every year you're adding the population of Montana. It just doesn't make sense in a country when we still have 40 to 50 million people who are not in the workforce, who could be in the workforce. Now, that said, I'm willing to negotiate some of the numbers if that's what it takes to get votes in the Congress. It's a relatively splittable difference. I certainly don't think we should go above 1 million. And if you look at public opinion surveys, pretty consistently, Americans think we should keep immigration level or we should take it down. Now, that's the opposite of what a lot of elites in Washington
think. Yeah, in fact,
think.
The narrative is, oh, we're a nation of immigrants. Everyone wants more immigrants. And the more I talk to people about it, they say, no, actually, schools are kind of getting overcrowded and there's a congestion problem and wages are flatlining.
Yeah. So we are a nation of immigrants. We're a nation of laws. And one of the most fundamental kind of law a nation has is how it decides who becomes a new citizen. The story of immigration is not one of the pilgrims landing here in the 17th century and then just ever more increases in immigration until you get to, you know, the poem on the Statue of Liberty. That's not the case. The story of immigration in our country is a period of starts and stops. Some of that's organic as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you had a big spike in immigration in the 19th century. A lot of the Irish immigration in this country
came in because
of the famine in Ireland. You had a big decline in immigration a couple of decades later, in large part because of our Civil War. Likewise, around the turn of the century, you had a lot of immigration from Eastern Europe and from Southern Europe. But that stopped in the 1920s, and that was a legal change, in part because there was such a surge in immigration, and people thought, we need to call a pause, we need to assimilate all of these new immigrants into our society, and we need to make sure that they all have jobs at work. And it's not surprising that after World War II, when that law was still in effect for another 20 years until the 1965 Immigration Act, we had some of the a period of the broadest, most widely shared prosperity mm-hmm. for working class Americans in our country's history. So the story of immigration in this country is a story not of ever increasing amounts of immigration, but of starts and stops, increases and pauses designed to fit the economic and social needs of our country.
Well, I'm afraid we're not politically at a place where we can stop. And that's where I'm afraid of, is that the right and left have their own reasons to keep the flow the way it is. And in the 80s, correct me if I'm wrong, the green card numbers were a fraction of where it went under H.W. Bush. I mean, it skyrocketed.
Oh, yeah. No, to reduce green cards from 1 million to, say, 500,000, this is not some radical proposal that's taking us back to the 1820s. This is going back to where we were in our lifetimes.
Reagan, for example.
No, it's just that especially over the last 20 to 25 years, there has been a consensus in Washington between both parties that we need ever increasing numbers of immigration. Whatever the question is about immigration, the answer is always more. Mm. And in many cases, it was a tacit agreement that we needed more illegal immigration, that if we couldn't get it through legal immigration, we might as well look the other way and let people cross our border and certainly not enforce immigration laws at the workforce. That is one reason why, along with trade policy, Donald Trump's central theme in 2016 was immigration policy, because it was the place where political leaders of both parties were most divorced from what their voters
That's
wanted.
That's a great point. And the base feels betrayed by their parties, by the party on this particular issue. It's amazing to see Senator Sanders used to be common sense on this issue.
Yeah, in 2015, he was asked about open borders, and his immediate response was, "Open borders, that is a Koch brothers proposal." Mm-hmm. And he's coming in part from the old left-wing union movement that oppose large-scale immigration, because union members, union leaders recognize that mass migration of unskilled and low-skilled workers undercut working Americans and undercut union negotiating power. This goes back for 40 or 50 years in the union movement in America. Mm-hmm. It's ironic that Bernie Sanders, a socialist, has had to move to the left on immigration and on guns, I would add, to make himself a viable presidential candidate. I don't think his heart's really in it if you see him talk about immigration.
Yeah.
But because the Democratic Party is so deeply committed to identity politics and largely ignores the concerns of working class Americans, Bernie Sanders had to move to the left on immigration. There's no doubt about it. But 5 years ago, 10 years ago, he sounded much more like me on immigration than he sounded like the mainstream Democratic elite in D.C.
So what are the prospects of your bill?
So this year, I don't see much happening with Nancy Pelosi in charge of the House.
Yeah, sure.
However, if the president can get reelected, which I think right now he's on path to do, it's going to be a tough reelection. He knows that. I think we all know that. But if he can get reelected, especially if we take back the House, which I think we can do, I think we're underdogs, but we're not long shots, I would suspect there's going to be something of a reckoning in the Democratic Party about just how far to the left they've moved.
Mm-hmm.
Much like you had in 1988, after they lost three straight presidential elections, and you had Bill Clinton and some other Democrats trying to rethink Democratic Party orthodoxy of the Dukakis Mondale era.
Yeah.
Now, they lost three in a row then, but I think today losing two in a row to Donald Trump would be equal to or worse than losing three in the 1980s. So I don't know if it'll pass in its entirety or in its current form, but I think we do have some level of recognition in the Democratic Party in that scenario that they need to recalibrate on immigration in particular, because it'll be a centerpiece issue again in this campaign,
I
believe.
Yes.
And if we once again win working class Americans in record numbers, I think you're going to have a lot of voices in the Democratic Party saying we need to get back to some kind of sanity on our policy on things like immigration, not just immigration, but gun control.
And it's the
and
constituents that
the
they dominate that have been undercut, the black community in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And have just been totally.
And you're already starting to see that a little bit. You know, look at how often James Carville loses his mind on MSDNC these days Bernie Sanders being the nominee. I mean, he's still going to vote for him, he says, but he knows that the party is lurching too far to the left. I mean, they're far to the left on so many of these questions of where Barack Obama was just 5 years ago.
Yeah, he ran on one woman, one man marriage. One man, one woman marriage.
Yeah, I mean, and if you believe about marriage what Barack Obama believed 8 years ago,
you're considered a bigot now.
A bigot, right? In America. Well, it shows you just how far they've moved.
And you by no means have to, you know, repeat this, but my one view of immigration that ties to abortion is, if we didn't have 3,000 abortions every single day, maybe we wouldn't have to import as many people from all across the world. But you can, you know, you're a very pro-life senator, and I appreciate that. But I just find it dreadfully ironic that the left will be perfectly okay with, you know, having 3,000 abortions a day, a million a year, and then say, oh, let's bring in people from halfway across the world. Something there does not add up in the political calculus. But anything else, Senator, you wanted to plug? I know you had a book that came out.
I had a book last year, a couple months ago. Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour of Arlington National Cemetery.
And thank you for your service, by the way.
Thank you. So between my tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, I served at Arlington National Cemetery with the Old Guard.
Can I ask you about Afghanistan quickly?
Sure.
What do you think of the proposal on the table?
I have to say I'm pretty skeptical about Taliban intentions. Mm-hmm. No one probably wants to bring troops home from Afghanistan more than the troops who have served there for 19 years now. But because of its location, far away from allies, far away from the oceans, it's hard for us to maintain counterterrorism pressure in Afghanistan, unlike, say, Syria, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, where we have strong allies on their borders, or we have ships in the water off their coasts. So I worry that if we act too precipitously, that we may lose the ability to conduct counterterrorism strikes in Afghanistan, which we have to remember is the place where the 9/11 attacks were plotted and hatched from. So I'll say I'm skeptical of Taliban intentions. We're in the middle of this pause. We'll see how things go.
It's going to move in the next couple of days, I think.
Yeah, but we need to engage in, I'd say, watchful waiting to see what we can expect from them. I'll say I'm skeptical of them, and I'm worried about our ability to keep pressure on terrorist organizations in the area where there is still the largest concentration of U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organizations anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Well, Senator, I interrupted you when you were plugging your book, so do it one more time just so our audience can get that.
So Sacred Duty is the story of Arlington National Cemetery. If you've ever been to the cemetery for a funeral, or you've been there to see the changing of the guard, or maybe you've seen the Old Guard perform in places like state funerals for George H.W. Bush about a year and a half ago, or you've seen them in inauguration, this is the inside story of those young soldiers. It's not really my story. I share a few thoughts and a few anecdotes from my time at the cemetery, but I spent a lot of time out there a couple years ago interviewing today's soldiers and hearing their story and what it means to our nation that we have soldiers that are performing those kind of vigils all night, all day long, every day of the year.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Cotton, for your service, and everyone check out the book, and we'll keep an eye on this virus and China and all the issues we discussed, and best of luck with everything.
All right. Thanks so much,
Senator. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Make sure to buy my new book, The MAGA Doctrine, M-A-G-A Doctrine, for sale in just a couple hours from now. So make sure you pick it up. And also, if you guys want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, everybody. Have you listened to our show on Spotify yet? If not, give it a try. If you have, tell a friend. Send them the link to our show on Spotify. We're finally on Spotify, Charlie Kirk Show on Spotify. And when you do, be sure to follow our show page. That way you'll get all the new episodes as they come out. Find them in your library. Download the Spotify app for free now. Simply search our show to start listening.